I think the challenge with like setting a big annual goal is that you actually discount how much you change over time, especially if you're really ambitious or growth oriented, like a lot of our listeners are. The person who's setting the goal in December is going to be different from the person who's actually executing that goal in June.
Right.
Right. So you want to make sure that you give future you, June you, a chance to weigh in with some qualitative feedback.
It reminds me of fitness. Like there's just like a natural tie into fitness here a little bit.
Because
to your point, like you may say, I want to lose weight, very popular goal. I'm going to lose 20 pounds and you're going to run every single day. But to your point about the June you, you know, your pace at running is in when you start in January. You don't have to wait until January, but your pace is going to be very different.
Absolutely.
Right? So it's
so
very
what felt
difficult.
Impossible
correct.
In December
correct.
Is going to feel very reasonable in June.
Correct. And the same thing happens in your financial life. Welcome to the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success, where we explore life at the intersection of money. I'm Julian.
And I'm Kirsten. Today, we are talking about goal setting.
Goal setting.
Yes.
I love goal setting.
Yeah. And this episode is actually dropping the week after Christmas. And I always feel like that week between Christmas and New Year's, is just full of high energy.
Yeah.
You know, you just came off of a bunch of family time, which depending on your family could either be restorative or stressful. But, you know, offices are usually closed most of the week or they close early. And if you have kids, they're home from winter break, eating you out of house and home.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel like some people are pumped that the holidays are over and they're jazzed about the new year.
Mm-hmm.
So they start doing all the rituals, the cleaning, the journaling, the vision boarding in anticipation of that big fresh start.
Yeah.
I'm using air quotes. Fresh start.
Yeah. I've never, what is it? Was it new year, new me, that whole
yes.
vibe? I've never been that person. I've never really set or... I've set goals, obviously, that's what we're talking about, but I've never been like big on resolutions. But anyway, like I'm kind of tripping. I mean, I am definitely, and this happens every year, like a lot of people, like I cannot believe the year went by so quickly.
Oh, I know.
It kind of like weeks felt like days.
Especially and, like, starting in like, what month was, I think it was October that felt like it lingered on forever. Or maybe it was September.
Yeah, it was one of them.
It was one of them. And then the rest of the months just like were like,
it just felt
girl.
Like weeks.
Yeah.
They just felt like a collection of a few weeks.
And December like, certainly has.
The whole thing is, yeah, you're right. December, the whole thing. Like it's just been amazing. But 2022, which sounds crazy,
I know.
Is almost here. Or I guess by the time some people are listening to it.
Yeah,
here,
if you don't listen to it regularly, it might be 2022.
Yeah.
So happy New Year's, y'all.
Yeah.
You're
yeah.
late.
Right.
Episode
right.
dropped last week.
Mm-hmm. But to your point, this is the time of year that a lot of people, you know, us included, start thinking about creating and setting goals for next year, which can be a daunting task. So hopefully we can offer some help and perspective to our listeners today.
Yeah. I don't know if it exists like this in other cultures, but just Americans just have this very specific relationship with the new year. We use it as this mechanism to start over
mm-hmm.
to the point where we'll wait to start things or do things
until the
calendar flips. Yeah. And in many cases, you don't need to wait.
Yeah.
So January 1st, while it may be symbolic, it's made up of the same components as January 18th or December 29th.
Right.
So those days are just as good to work on your habits. And especially when it comes to finances, the quicker you act, the better off you'll be. So today we wanted to share a few of our best tips and lessons about goal setting.
Let's do it.
Yeah. So when we first met, you actually had a really structured process for your annual goal setting.
Yeah.
I remember it was like written on like a legal pad
and you
had little sections drawn out and it was categorized. Do you still do that? Like or has it evolved over the years?
First of all, I haven't seen a legal pad.
You were the only brother I knew that had legal pads in like 2000.
I used to go out and get it was something about the yellow. Like, some of them were white too, but it was just something about it that just seemed very
official.
Yeah, it was like,
no, it's real when it's on legal pad.
It's a piece of paper. It's just paper. But it was something about it that made me feel like, all right, let's get serious. I'm breaking out the legal pad across my legs. But no, so a lot of it stemmed from, I think, like my earliest memory of kind of planning things out really efficiently and in detail was in undergrad. And so I remember you used to get like a course book, and it had all of the course codes and the descriptions categorized by like majors or, you know, all those different areas that you could study. And I remember taking that book when I first started and writing out literally every single class that I was going to take by semester for my entire thing. And like planning, like, all right, so if I start at this time, 4 years from now, I will be taking this course. And you know, it was really, really weird. And I found nothing wrong or odd about this process at all.
It's a sense of control.
I guess so, but like I learned very quickly that like things change, like immediately, almost immediately, you know, it was like, oh man, I remember going back to my pad, like, oh man, well, what am I supposed to do? Again, I had no idea what I was doing, but it was helpful for me to sort of map it out and say, all right, if I follow the plan, I can be done. And essentially it almost, it's like being able to appoint control and predict my own future and say, I will be walking across that stage in June or May of this particular year, which seems really far out, but it was like, no, here's the book.
Right.
These are the courses. This is what you have to take, two of these, four of these, at least one of these. And so, And I think that process, and obviously going into professional work environments and going through, not formally, but I guess participating in other planning meetings and that sort of thing, really made me say, well, I wonder what of my academic and my professional experience I can kind of, you know, use in my personal life and specifically now my financial life. But what's interesting is I do none of this. I do none of it now. Like none of it. Yeah. Like all of that was just completely balled up, thrown into the trash. It's a completely 180 shift. I take a much more free spirited approach these days. Like I may go to the extent of writing out like a business ambition or a plan, but I'm certainly not going into like a detailed or precise process as I used to.
Yeah. I still set goals, but I actually limit it to like 5 to 8, certainly no more than 10.
Okay.
But of those, and this may be a shocker, only one or two of them are specific to finances.
Okay.
The rest are related to how I spend my time, how I take care of my body and my mind, what kind of habits I want to build. But like you, I used to be the opposite. I used to have lots of goals. Most of them were related to money. And then like one or two were about the other areas of my life that I could obviously do once I had the money. So what I've learned after 37 years of living and over 2 decades of like intense goal setting is that creating a list of purely financial goals isn't particularly useful.
Okay.
Right? What I've learned is that getting better with money is usually a side effect of behavior changes in other areas of your life. We tend to think that money is going to shape our behaviors. Like, you know, once I get this new job, then I'll have more money and I can eat healthier.
Yeah.
So we get hyper-focused on just getting the new job. But realistically, it's the other way around. If you can find creative ways to eat healthy, regardless of your financial situation, or find ways to squeeze in like a 10-minute calisthenics workout, even during your busiest times, you actually teach your brain to think more expansively. And that spills into how you manage your money. You start to become more aware of the opportunities that you have to kind of improve incrementally or little by little.
Yeah, I can see that. That's really cool. You know, you mentioned almost 2 years and it's really making me think about my own. But you're right. There's a lot of value and I think wisdom that you collect and you learn about yourself and your own processes over a 2 year period. Like I can look back on at least 20 years of adulthood and make some pretty good assessments of like what has worked and what hasn't worked. I think one of the big things for me, and it's very similar to what you're saying, is that is the importance of building healthy habits. And I say that because it's the habits that actually make goal achievement possible. And so when we talk about habits, like, it, you know, if we like to break it down, and I'm sure someone has, there's literally a book, very popular book called
Atomic Habits.
Well, there's and then there's another one. I think it's just Habits. I remember it's like a yellow and red book. I think
I'm
visualizing it in my mind. But I do remember that book. Anyway, I'm sure someone's broken it down and it might actually be in that book. But like you can break that down into things like discipline and organization or in some cases like just omission and all of these other characteristics and skills that kind of get you closer to doing something more regularly without distraction or interference or delay or mm-hmm. procrastination or any of those things. And that's one of the things that I've really, really learned is like how important it is. And I'm saying I've learned that because I did not do that very well, because I always used to just think that like brute force was going to break you through. And I was like, actually, no, you got to really break these things down and focus on habits. So one of the habits or practices, I would say, that you and I do and still do that we've maintained. This is one thing that I think has certainly helped guide us to a lot of our successes over the last 10 years is annual planning. Mm-hmm. And so for our listeners out there, every year we spend, it's probably minimum four, but like upwards of 6 hours in a day just sitting and talking about what we want, what we need to make happen in the coming year. We write it down, we map it out, we search for alignment. Actually, I think it's more important to also search for conflicts.
Yes.
Where it's like, hey, help me explain how you're going to do this thing and
right.
this thing. Like these two don't happen because this only, or these two things conflict, whether it be because of the time of the year or cost or something like that. But the sole purpose of this exercise is just setting ourselves up to achieve the goals or our life goals that we are aiming for, which is inclusive of our financial goals. I think it's a great way of kind of getting everything out of your head and mm-hmm. onto a page so you can get realistic about what's possible and call attention to the things that don't occur regularly, right? So, you know, years for the most part, especially you wake up, go to work,
mm-hmm.
weekend comes, take a break, you know, but like every now and then things happen, life
right.
happens. And so it's really, you know, helpful when you're doing annual planning because you can identify where you're going to have some disruptions and then start moving things or at least planning to solve for a lot of those problems. Now, having said that, annual planning may not be enough for you. It may not work for you if you're listening and thinking, hey, we should do that. And in those cases, it's typically because it's just too big of an exercise.
Yeah. Boiling the ocean.
Yeah, you're boiling the ocean, as they say. And I think one of the more important ways to solve for that is to just take that and break it up into what they call sprints, which is bringing me back to my corporate
days
of agile methodologies and that sort of thing. But it's basically just the little things that build up to the bigger things.
Right.
So just focus on what's in front of you, those things. Obviously, you're mindful of what's coming next, especially if there's a sequential relationship between what you want to do and what has to happen in order for the next thing to happen. But that makes it a little bit more digestible. It's like that old saying of how do you eat an elephant.
One bite at a time.
So one step at a time, $1 at a time, one whatever it is at a time.
Yes. And it ultimately all adds up. Yeah. I've also learned that lesson about setting financial goals. And I have had to resist the urge to set one big annual goal, right? I like the idea of quarterly sprints. And that's what the planning process does, which is allows me to break it up and to see what the milestones associated with that goal are, what activities I need to be doing to hit that goal. But I think the challenge with like setting a big annual goal is that you actually discount how much you change over time, especially if you're really ambitious or growth oriented, like a lot of our listeners are. The person who's setting the goal in December is going to be different from the person who's actually executing that goal in June.
Right.
So you want to make sure that you give future you, June you, a chance to weigh in with some qualitative feedback. There may be things that she's learned about the nature of the goal that kind of change the expectation, or maybe you've accomplished the goal, but it doesn't feel good and needs another, you know, just kind of remixing. You just need to be able to leave room for future you to weigh in.
It reminds me of fitness. Like there's just like a natural tie into fitness here a little bit. Because to your point, like you may say, I want to lose weight, very popular goal. I'm going to lose 20 pounds and you're going to run every single day. But to your point about the June you know, your pace at running is in when you start in January. You don't have to wait until January, but your pace is going to be very different.
Absolutely.
Right? So it's
so
very
what felt
difficult.
Impossible
correct.
In December
correct.
Is going to feel very reasonable in June.
Correct. And the same thing happens in your financial life. It's like, oh, well, that's not even my problem anymore.
Right.
The problem that you identified in January is not going to be the problem
exactly.
that you have or the struggle that you have in June.
I love that example because losing weight is one of those. We're going to talk about vanity metrics later in the show, but it's one of those metrics that you think is the problem. But in June, you could be weighing the exact same amount, but just leaner and fitter.
Correct.
And you realize, I've been focusing on the wrong goal. I've been focusing on weight. Right. But I should have been focusing on, you know, habits and health and endurance and stamina.
Yep.
I actually remember when this would come up for us when we were in debt payoff mode. We'd sprint through the first quarter, throwing every single dime at our debt. And by March, we'd be exhausted and burnt out. And we would have this choice to make.
Yep.
If we use some of the money that was supposed to go towards our debt to book a vacation, it would delay our goal. But if we pushed through and went forward with our plans, there wouldn't be a chance to take another vacation for a couple of months,
right,
because you need to save up money in order to not get back in debt. And so before, this dilemma would be this huge point of conflict for us. And for you, it would feel like we weren't keeping our integrity and our word with ourselves. But for me, it would feel like the opposite. It would feel like we were holding space for a version of us that was evolving. So now we've learned to build goals with breathing room. And we kind of discover, you know, those points of conflict during the planning process.
Yep.
And we'll schedule a meeting, you know, 75% of the way towards the goal and determine, like, if it does it still feel good, and kind of adjust course if we need to.
Yeah. No, that's a really good point. I give you a lot of credit for that, because I think you're right. Right. And we talk about that in terms of, like, making sure that we remind people to reward themselves throughout the process. Because it's really about maintaining motivation, and going back to what I was saying about habits. Like, if you don't enjoy the process, if you're not enjoying the process, there's very little incentive to keep doing it, right? That's just not how our brains are that's just not how our brains are wired.
Right.
Yep. So this is also making me think about the nerd in me. I remember I used to be pretty obsessive about Microsoft Excel and creating spreadsheets and all of these different projections. But one of my favorite functions, shout out to the Microsoft Excel nerds out there, is the what if analysis, which is basically functionality in Microsoft Excel that allows you to explore different variables. So, like, let's say you got your classic example, you're selling t-shirts and you've got to sell this many t-shirts in order to make this much money. These are the inputs in terms of, like, the cost of cotton and ink, and this is how much a t-shirt press is going to cost, and this is how much you could make if it's at this price or something like that. The what if functionality would allow you to explore a variety of different things. Well, this is what your profit might be, but what if the price of this changes, or what if these things change, or, you know, the price of ink goes up, or if the cost of the press, or you need a bigger press or something like that, right? What impact does that have on quantity, quality, pricing, et cetera? And I think that's important to do whenever you're doing annual planning and looking at your finances. It's important to have a solid plan that says, all right, this is what I am going to do based on the information that I know and have access to today. Mm-hmm. But you should also be building in these other little pieces. You don't have to do a full-blown analysis, but what if I get promoted earlier than I think, right? Because you're working towards something. What if I get promoted? What if I have a windfall of money? What impact does that have on my ability to accomplish some of my goals? What if I get a bigger bonus this year for whatever reason? Mm-hmm. Conversely, what happens if you lose income,
right,
or income is eliminated? What is the plan? What is the bare bones budget? Where are you going to live?
Mm-hmm.
Who are you going to call? You know, all of those different things I think is really important. But anyway, it just made me think about the what if analysis. And I think if you're considering doing a budget for the first time, those aren't necessarily things that people think of. They think of a budget as it's written in stone.
Yes.
And this is what life is going to be. And I was like, well, actually, good and bad things can happen.
Yeah.
Life can happen. And so you should, you know, again, you don't have to create three different budgets because you can't predict the future, but you should at least be mindful of what would happen so that when or if those things occur, you have something. You're not starting from zero.
Yes.
You're not freaking out. You're saying, actually, I already gave this some thought.
Yeah.
This is exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to carve out. I'm going to keep 20% for myself, and I'm going to throw the extra 80% at this new debt, or I'm going to invest in these things, right?
Right.
So having that plan in place and ready to go, I think, is really, really important.
Yeah, you bring up another downside of setting annual goals, particularly around budgeting, because people assume a steady state of spending and earning throughout the year.
Yeah.
But if you actually look at your finances closely, and this is why we recommend using technology and apps and those year-end reports that your credit card companies and your banks will send you, you actually realize that for most people, your behaviors change based on the season. Mm-hmm. So in our house, we spend more money in the summer because the days are longer and we're out of the house, catching up with friends, vacationing, doing all that jazz. And then the same thing happens in the winter, starting at Thanksgiving and continuing into January. We're home more, there's Christmas and all the gifts, and there's more spending.
Yep.
So we make sure to build that into our budgeting and plan in advance to spend more during those times. And there isn't this existential crisis when it warms up and we're spending more money because we're not beholden to a plan that doesn't suit our needs.
Yeah.
But it took us a long time to get there because a lot of the leading voices in finance disagree with that approach.
Yeah.
They believe in seasons of extreme sacrifice to hit your goals, whether it's debt payoff or something else, in the shortest amount of time as possible. So they'll say things like no eating out, no vacations, no nothing until you hit that goal.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, in terms of goal setting, what are your thoughts on seasons of extreme focus?
I think there's value in that, right? I mean, there's a reason why people are beating the drum to right. that song. I think for a lot of people, it works. It's effective. That's exactly what they need. That's what they need to be told. And it works for them. I think for everyone else, they may have, you know, or prefer more flexible goals, right? Everyone's a little different. I think there's value in that. I don't know that there's a right or a wrong. I think about it more so from you know, the limitations that it puts on you from a problem-solving perspective. And I alluded to this earlier. I think if you focus on cutting back as a way of getting ahead all the time, what you're calling like extreme focus, even if you're just talking about like income generation, like that I think can be destructive. And I think it biases your approach to problem-solving. Mm-hmm. Like you have to maintain, I think, flexibility or mindfulness of all of the different variables or levers that can be pulled in order to solve a problem.
Yes.
This is a math problem. It's also obviously an emotional sort of challenge here, but sometimes the answer is or should be cutting back. Sometimes the answer could be really, really focusing on selling and earning income. Sometimes it could be a little bit of both. Other times it could be, hey, I need the energy to focus on one or the other, which means I'm going to have to automate other things or outsource right. other things. And so you just want to make sure that you're designing a life and a budget and a spending plan, whatever you want to call it, that has all of those other, I think, qualitative factors in mind. Because That's what makes it yours, and ultimately that's what I think is going to lead to you getting the types of results that you want.
Totally agree. I think what it boils down to are systems, which is the way that you want to accomplish something, versus goals, which are what you want to accomplish. Both are important, and both need to be developed and analyzed together.
Yeah, it makes regularly. Me. Yeah, I'm thinking about like my laptop. I bought a laptop. I didn't design one myself, but you start to customize your
exactly.
laptop, just like you customize your browser and
your
all
phone.
Of those other things
yeah.
that are unique to you. So you can take one of these plans or mantras or ideas from someone else, your favorite personal finance personality, but ultimately you need to make it yours. You need to customize it. And that's what I think is going to help a lot of people.
Perfect. We'll be right back after the break. Okay, so we've talked about how you don't have to wait till January 1st to start, how getting better with money is typically a side effect of other behaviors in your life, and the importance of zooming in on the year and establishing milestones, plans that acknowledge seasonal shifts. So the next thing I want to talk about is how you measure progress. And you know I like to nerd out on stuff related to brains. And as I'm preparing to write my business goals for next year, I've been skimming this incredible book by Andreas Nieder called A Brain for Numbers, The Biology of the Number Instinct. And it's all about humans' fascination with numbers and keeping score and tracking metrics.
Like fascination is the operative
yes.
word.
Yes. So anyway, what I've learned so far is that our numbers instinct is what he calls it. Our numbers instinct is actually an evolutionary trait. It's deeply rooted because it used to be attached to our survival. No surprise there.
I feel like everybody's kind of
everything is
playing
attached
that
to
card
our survival.
At this point.
But it's true.
Right.
So so think about it. It's evolutionary. Biological.
Sure.
You can't help it.
I'm going to say that about everything.
Why'd you leave your cup right there? It's evolutionary. Biological.
You got to think about when I was a single-celled
when I was a kid,
organism.
Yeah. Okay, so, but think about it. I'm going to give you his rationale. So think about counting, even at a basic level. Back when we were cavemen, our ability to distinguish a small amount of food versus a large amount of food had an advantage of how much you could eat. And even when it came to safety, you needed to be able to tell if you were outnumbered, if you encountered a tribe, in order to know whether you need to run or whether you needed to fight, right? So we have this instinct, but the problem is in modern times, we are now inundated with a bunch of numerical information that doesn't actually matter.
Yeah.
But we still think that it does. We still think that it's like a survival mechanism because it's so deeply rooted in us.
Okay.
You know, I mean, think about all the things that are counted right now that you have access to. You at any given time know how many emails you have, how many notifications you've missed, text messages, your heart rate, how many hours you've slept, stock prices.
Yeah. Yeah. No, listen, I get it. We're completely inundated with a bunch of useless information. And I think a lot of people, I guess because I'm desensitized to it. Maybe that's what it is. But you're right. Like, there are a lot of people who really lock in and care and focus on all of those things. They react to it. And it really makes me think about, I remember, you know, and you know, even as entrepreneurs, we kind of deal with this too. It's like, which metrics matter the most? What should we be paying attention to? What should be, which ones are the driving indicators of our success? And it's the whole idea of the difference between data and insights, right? So, like, I remember just receiving a bunch of reports, a bunch of data, a bunch of stuff. And I was like, well, what are we doing with this stuff? Nothing. Not reacting to it at all. It's just FYI. And I was like, all right, well, which of these, like, should we really be caring about? All of it, but none of it.
Right.
Some of it. This today, other things tomorrow. So, yeah, I totally get that. I do think that when it comes to data, though, that there's value in data, obviously. But I think that a lot of people are missing the boat because when we hear the word data, most people think numbers. They don't think about qualitative data, which is going to be like, how does this feel? Like, explain it to me. Describe it. And you can sort of add numbers to that stuff too. But I think that that's something that I think going back to annual planning is something that a lot of people should be doing. And we've spoken about this with respect to budgeting before. But I think in addition to, let's say, having a budget and a spending plan, as you're having these, whether it's annual or quarterly meetings, you really need to be tracking what that process felt like. How did it feel? What is a little journal entry? Something so that when you're looking back, especially these days, because like things are moving so quickly, it's so helpful to look back at, let's say, a budget 10 years ago when you were making, you know, significantly less money, most likely, and reading how incredibly happy you were.
Right.
You know what I mean? There's something to that because then fast forward 10 years, 15 years, you're earning more. You don't have the same problems as we've been talking about because you've been growing throughout your life and your career, but you're not nearly as happy as you were.
Right.
Right. Like I remember that. Like those were like really big deals.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I don't want to go back into like another sort of eye roll inducing statistic, but there's that whole stat around $75,000 being the amount of money that really sort of most people need in order to be happy, and that every dollar earned after that really doesn't give you that same dose of happiness. Certainly in our experience, we've experienced that. And again, it's a first world problem, but
right.
I'm just kind of giving that perspective that there's value to that. And I think one of the best things that you can do to counter that, or at least try to remedy that challenge, is to start documenting it along the way. I wish I had access to a journal entry or comments. It's no different than like leaving a review for a hotel or a restaurant or something like that. I really enjoyed this process. This is what I did. This is what I bought, and it was great. And I think a lot of people could benefit from doing that.
Yeah, you bring up a good example with the salary thing because there is a name for metrics or numbers that are really easy to track, but generally have no bearing on whether you're thriving or it's meaningful to you. They don't contribute to your well-being. And eventually people learn that salary might be one of those numbers for them.
Yeah.
But the category for those metrics is called vanity metrics.
Okay.
So It's things, again, that are easy to track. They get your attention, but they're ultimately a distraction because they don't add to the things that matter to you in your life.
Yeah.
So in business, you might hear people talk about how much revenue they've made, but top line revenue is arguably a vanity metric. What really matters is how much the operating costs are and how much profit was made to know if that business is a sustainable business or not.
Right.
So the more attention you pay to vanity metrics, the less time you actually have to focus on the things that matter. And again, this is a very personal thing. I can say for me, the things that I think are vanity metrics in my life. I can say that I think the concept of a FI number is a vanity metric in my life. I can explain that the number of Instagram followers that I have is a vanity metric in my life. But I don't know that I can offer this carte blanche opinion of what other people's are, because I don't know what ultimate goal they're after.
Right.
Like we have different objectives. So anyway, before this turns into like an unhelpful rant, I think my advice for people is after you've written out your goals, after you've gone through the annual planning and all the things we've suggested, go back and do a gut check on the metrics. For each one, ask yourself why you want to accomplish it and who you get to be or what you get to feel once you hit it. This is actually a practice that I do after I set my goals in creating a journal prompt. And I ask myself these questions every week, twice a week. I ask myself, you know, how much does my life change when I'm making twice as much money? And I'll write things like, oh, I get to pay somebody to clean my house, and I'll vacation twice a month. Right. I'll have a babysitter and a date night once a week. And by bringing my awareness to what I've attached to the goal, I can see more clearly if it's a vanity metric or something that is, you know, clearly actually meaningful to my life. I can go deeper on the goal to figure out why I want to hit it.
Yeah, I think in personal finance, there's certainly a lot of vanity metrics. There's just a lot, right?
There are a lot of vanity metrics. Stock prices, when you bought it and what it is today.
Yeah.
That's such a vanity metric.
Yeah.
I just want to rant. Sorry, y'all.
So if we were to pick one, I stand by this, and we've said this before, but I think certainly one that I would not consider a vanity metric, and I think in the past we've gone so far as to say it's the only personal finance metric that matters, but it's net worth. Mm-hmm. And for those who may be new to that term or may just need a reminder, and I've come to learn that even trying to be kind here, but let me do a quick little sidebar. I remember having a conversation with a former coworker who, you know, I'd given him a recommendation. We were talking about net worth and how important it was. And I gave him a tool recommendation, and he told me the tool was wrong because it didn't factor in his credit score. And I was really confused. Like, I you know, not to be disrespectful, but I thought he was joking. Mm. But he was like, this is not factoring in like my credit score and like
like how much credit he has access to.
Yeah, I think that's what he was trying to get at, which is that, you know, I have this sort
of worth more
credit limit because I have access to this. Yeah. It never crossed my mind that someone would even think that. So if you think that has no bearing on your net worth, and so,
right,
which is why we're going to explain net worth a little bit here. So net worth is essentially the difference between the market value of your assets less your liabilities. And so an asset is essentially something that you own that has value. Cash has value. Your investment accounts, like your 401k, your IRA, 529s, a brokerage account, all of those things. Your car has market value. The property that you own has value. Now, conversely, you may have contracts or agreements where you owed in order to purchase some of those assets. So you don't do that for cash, but something like your home. If you own a home, you may have a mortgage against it. So if your home is valued at $200,000 and you owe $100,000, well, then that's a $100,000 equity that you have in that home that contributes to your net worth in a positive way. And so what you do is you add up the value of all of the assets, then you subtract the value of all of the liabilities, everything that you owe, and the difference is your net worth.
Right.
And I think this is important for a lot of people because it's the one thing that I think if you had to pick something that you're going to use to measure financial progress, it's that. It's not credit scores or even income. Those are contributing factors for sure, but they're not things that I think ultimately should be focused on. Like if you had to pick one, certainly net worth. And there are two tips on this that I would offer our listeners. The first one, as you're doing your annual planning and thinking about, all right, well, what are we anticipating or aiming for with your net worth? Is to be mindful of not setting very specific targets. So when you're talking about collecting assets that appreciate in value, it's arguably impossible for you to project what the future value of those assets are going to be.
Right?
That's not really the purpose of net worth. You can say, hey, I at a minimum would like to see this type of impact to my net worth based on, let's say, your contributions, your cash contributions, or your contributions to an investment account or something like that. But you don't really know how much it's going to grow specifically over any period of time. It could decline or decrease in value. All right. But if you are, let's say, focused on just debt elimination mode, it's a lot easier for you to get very, very specific because you can say, yes, I'm going to eliminate this $30,000 debt over this period of time. And as a result, at a minimum, I should see this type of impact to my net worth. So that's something that I think is worthy of calling out. And the second thing is using a tool. Mm-hmm. Unless you are an expert in Microsoft Excel, I don't even think I've opened Excel in a really long time. At this point, a lot of things are just automated or I use technology. Our favorite tool for calculating net worth is Personal Capital, but you can also use Mint. There are other tools out there if you are an enthusiast for cryptocurrency that will also connect to a wallet or wireless that you have. But these tools look at your property value. They look at your investment accounts. They sort of map it all out and chart it all out for you so that you can see what the impact is, what's leading to your net worth in a positive way, what's sort of pulling from it in terms of bills and debts and liabilities and all those things. It can get a little difficult, especially if you're not familiar with how to use tools like Excel. So that's why these tools are important.
I love the focus on net worth. I think it's the North Star that we should be using for a lot of definitions, even the definition of what counts as saving, what counts as investing. Like it's anything that contributes to your net worth, right? Positively.
Yep.
Right. So I love ending on that. So there you have it, friends. Go forth. Be the gold diggers that I know you to be. Mm. Get it?
Slow down.
Gold diggers. That sounds like, the L and the D kind of combined. I am saying goal. G-O-A-L, diggers.
We get it.
You didn't laugh, though.
Oh, because we've heard it before.
All right, final thoughts.
Okay, why don't you kick us off?
All right, so my final thought is to not let culture dictate what your goals should be.
Okay.
You should make your own goals that are true to you. And if you aren't sure how to articulate it using words or numbers, then create a vision board. This is something that I do every single year, but basically you find pictures of people, places, things, vibes that best capture the kind of life that you want to live. And what I do is I put it on a board. I put it somewhere where I see it every day. And that board becomes my inspiration throughout the year. It's a nice way to hold myself accountable and audit my progress without the harshness of numbers and other social metrics that are really popular right now. So that is my final thought. If you don't know what number or what word you can assign to it, then just use pictures.
Really, really cool. And you're good at that. You've been doing that for as long as I've known you. So it's pretty cool. My final thoughts are really for the novices out there. And I just really want to focus on you guys a little bit. If this is your first time digging into your financial life in a very serious or structured way, or your first time doing it with a partner, it's going to get uncomfortable. And I'm just telling you right now, but I can assure you that it will get easier. We've spoken about like the parallels between this process and exercising. I would also encourage you to think about it the same way you would starting a new job. Those first weeks, you have absolutely no idea what you're doing. You don't know where anything is. But over time, your confidence grows. You start to see the value that you bring to the table. If you're doing this with a partner, you'll start to see that they may have a fundamentally different idea. Try to find the value that they bring through the table, right, through that process. And naturally, you individually or as a couple or as a team will get better at it. I think so much of improving your financial life has to do with managing your emotions. And so as much as we like to think or believe that this is a brainy exercise, that this is all about analysis, so much of it is about managing and trying to control your emotions so that you don't get distracted or discouraged along the way. If you don't know the answer to something, you can always find the answer or get someone to find the answer to a question, but do not let that sort of set the tone for this experience. This is really about trusting and understanding your own process. And once you do that, and through a lot of practice, it just gets easier. So I'm hoping that these words of encouragement will help, and that this time next year, we can look back on this experience and say, wow, I can't believe that I was afraid to do these things, because here we are, a lot richer than we were 365 days ago.
Cheers to that. Well, thank you for listening to another episode of the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success. If you like what you heard, one of our goals is to get up to 100 reviews on Apple Podcasts.
Getting close.
So please leave us a 5-star rating and review so I can move on. I'd like to cross this off my list. Thank you, guys. We will see you next week.